You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Yeah, this is something pretty big because a lot of big names actually were involved in this matter. Besides you, of course, a lot of people came out to support you. Names like Ralph Nader, Michael Moore. Do you hang out with these people or do you know them, or did they just hear about what happened and they said, look, we support what you did?
Well, a little of both. I have met Ralph Nader a couple of times, and he has been a strong supporter. Actually, he's a member of Veterans for Peace, and he's been a strong supporter of our organization. He's an associate member, as I was mentioning before. I don't know if he would say, oh, yes, Leah Bolger, I know her well. I know who he is, of course, and I've met him several times. But we asked him for a statement of support, which he came up with, a very strong statement. Michael Moore, his website posted the video, the C-SPAN video that was also included the clips of Ben Cohen. Ben and Jerry's Ben Cohen speaking in support of me. Now, Ben has been a friend of Veterans for Peace for some time, and the guy who did the editing, Bill Kinsey, is a friend of Ben Cohen's, and so Bill wanted to help, and he enlisted Ben and made this video with the interview with Ben and did a phone interview with me and cut that into it. So it made this great video that was then posted on Michael Moore's website, and then Michael Moore tweeted about it, and Roseanne Barr tweeted about it. It is amazing what celebrities have the power to make things go viral and to really make an impact. If they hear these interviews, that they would do more of that. Not that their voices are so much more powerful, but that they have so many people follow them or watch what they do or watch what they endorse, and
right,
they have outreach and exposure. Michael Moore has over 1 million followers. And
wow,
after he tweeted about my video, I immediately had like 50 people following me that weren't there 5 minutes prior. So it is important that people who have that kind of notoriety, they can really make a difference. And Michael Moore tweeting about me or writing about me or whatever could make a huge difference in how many people watch the video, how many people know about what I did, and how many people know about Veterans for Peace. And it could make a huge difference. So we're always reaching out to any kind of media to get our voice out there. I've done a lot of interviews since this all happened, and I'm happy to do them, and it's great. And I really appreciate independent voices like yours or independent avenues of non-corporate media helping us tell the truth.
My pleasure. You know, I've often thought, why aren't there more prominent people, celebrities, who speak out against war? Seems like that used to happen a lot in the 60s, and it doesn't happen anymore. Are there any prominent people out there who support Veterans for Peace, besides what we just talked about?
Yes, I mentioned Howard Zinn, of course.
Right.
Ed Asner, the actor, is a member. Chris Christopherson, the musician, is a lifetime member. Daniel Ellsberg, of course. David Courtwright is a member. He's a prominent author on war. David Swanson is a member who's written several books, War is a Lie. I should have looked this up before.
No, that's
before
okay.
You
just
me.
You know what? It's the usual suspects, though. It doesn't seem like there's new people coming in. That's what I don't get. How could these people have a lot of money? They're
mm-hmm.
really living a comfortable life.
Mm-hmm.
They have to know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
How could they just sit there and wake up and get a massage, have their
mm-hmm.
breakfast cooked for them, and not really voice their opinion about how we're talking about horrible stuff. War is horror. I can't understand how these people don't feel some kind of a moral obligation
mm-hmm.
to say something. You know what? I'm lucky. I'm an actor. I'm making a lot of money. I really don't do much for it. I just
mm-hmm.
pretend to be somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm lucky. What can I say? There's many, many, many more people who are not as lucky as I am, and the people who are getting killed for no reason in actions that are illegal from 9/11, which many scholars believe was not committed by the folks in the government who say that it was 19 Muslims in a cave that shut down the entire air defense system in the United States for the amount of time they did. You would think that these people would say, look, enough is enough. All right, I'm comfortable enough. Let me stand up for these people who have no voice. Ed Asner has been doing this for decades.
Mm-hmm.
Ralph Nader's been doing this for decades.
Mm-hmm.
But it just seems like there's nobody out there. Why do you think that is? Do you think they realize that if they talk out against war, because Hollywood is so inextricably linked to the military-industrial complex, that they might lose their jobs? Do you think
mm-hmm.
that has to do with it, that they just don't want to give up all their comforts?
Well, it could be. I don't know. It could be that they would be blackballed like McCarthy era. I don't know. So, yes, you know, it does seem to me like, man, if they just took advantage of the power that they have, they could be so effective. Like I said, Michael Moore tweeted one time to refer people to my video on the website, and that was helpful. But if he had retweeted it a few more times, I think it could have made so much more difference. I think right now we have like 13,000 views of that video, which is, that's good, but it should be 130,000. It should be 300,000. It should
absolutely
be a whole lot more than that.
I could have my cat jump over the table and knock over my...
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
Right.
So I don't know what the trick is for something to go viral. It has been very, very gratifying to the people who have seen it and who have called me and sent me money to pay for my travel expenses and legal expenses, and people just sending me emails and calling me and saying, thank you for what you did. I support you. You're not alone. I wish I could have done that. So it makes me feel quite gratified that I did speak on behalf of the majority of people, and we are growing in the courage of our convictions, and it's not enough just to be mad as hell. We're starting to rise up and find our voice, our collective voice.
Right. So let's get to that day here.
Okay.
I'm looking at the C-SPAN archives, Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction Hearing on Discretionary Spending, October 26, 2011. By the way, I don't have a cat. I was just using that as a... Why did you go to this hearing, and how did you decide that you were going to interrupt it, knowing that you were not allowed to?
Well, I live in Oregon normally, and I was in Washington for the whole month of October as part of the occupation of Freedom Plaza. So whenever I'm in Washington, I try to find ways to participate and watch and monitor what's being done in my name. And so this particular committee, the super committee, as I mentioned, was very, very closed and secretive. And where and when they met, it was not open to the public. And what they discussed was not public knowledge. And in fact, members of the super committee were criticized by their peers, other people in Congress, senators and representatives who were not part of this elite 12-member committee. They were widely criticized by not just the public, but their peers, because they were so private. Several members of the super committee said that that was necessary because they were trying to build trust and collegiality within the super committee so that people could feel free to speak freely and candidly about their positions. And that was the excuse they used. They were given unprecedented authority and extraordinary powers. So it was really very counter to what our democracy is supposed to be about, this committee in the first place. Then when you find out that this committee was not granting access to anybody else in Congress, but they were granting access to these 250 lobbyists, and I read about that in several different articles. I didn't just make that up. And the lobbyists were gloating about it, that they had access and no one else did. So there came this opportunity. I think the super committee held a total of 3 public hearings where it was announced when and where, and the public was allowed to attend. And the hearing I attended, I believe, was the 3rd and last hearing. And so any member of public can attend committee hearings at Capitol Hill, and they have various hearing rooms, and it's no problem. That's your right as a citizen to participate in your government and to watch what's going on, listen to what's going on. So I attended this particular hearing, and I got there early, and I was on the front row of the gallery section. The gallery is cordoned off in the back of the room by velvet rope, like you might see in a theater. And then in front of the gallery was rows, many, many rows of media tables, press tables. And then in front of the press table were witnesses' chairs and small witness table. And then in front of that, the witness table is where the committee sits. And this was in the Hart Senate hearing room, which is quite a large hearing room. And it's very ornate with lots of marble. And it's a big hearing room. It holds a lot of people. So I listened to the testimony of this sole witness for like over an hour, and I really had not intended to interrupt because I had done something similar a week before. I had interrupted the Armed Services Committee hearing in the Rayburn office building that was being chaired by Representative McKeon, and he was having Panetta, the Secretary of Defense, and General Dempsey, the Chair of the Joint Chiefs, were going to testify about, they were supposed to be talking about budget cuts and moving forward. And Representative McKeon, after his introductory remarks, he was pretty much just saying, don't worry, guys, we're not going to cut anything. If we defund any of these programs, then the terrorists are going to get us, and don't worry, and we know it's important. So I interrupted him, and I was arrested for that. And so I had a charge pending, an open case. So the way it works in D.C. is if you have an open case and you're arrested a second time, you you most likely will be held overnight in central lockup, and it's not pleasant. I've done it a couple times. I really was not planning on interrupting because I knew I had this other case open. But the longer I sat there and listened and realized that the voice of the people was not being heard, nobody was speaking on behalf of the American people and what we want, and then I thought, I'll never get an opportunity like this again. This is a chance to be heard, and I'm going to take it. I was very calm. I stepped over this theater rope, and I walked to the front of the hearing room, and I stood next to Dr. Elmendorf, and I accused him of obfuscating the truth. He was talking about percentage of GDP and that our military spending really isn't that bad when you look at it that way, and it had nothing to do with the facts of the matter, which are we spend more on the military machine than the rest of the world combined, and our priorities are not on military. Our priorities are different. Senator Murray, who is the chair of the committee, banged the gavel almost immediately and tried to ask me to stop speaking, and I just kept going. So I think it was a total of 52 seconds between when I started speaking and when the door closed behind me as I was being hustled out by police officers. But I got a lot said in 52 seconds. And Kevin Zeese, so one of my supporters, a very prominent activist and spokesman for the movement, said I got more out in 45 seconds than the whole super committee combined, more of substance. And in fact, I was the only citizen who testified, albeit uninvited, testified before Congress. So I was glad that I had this opportunity, and I'm glad that I was able to take advantage of it and truly express the will of the people.
It does seem like such an obscene, rigged game and a joke that these people want to pretend that they're there doing the people's business and they won't even let one person speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I love what you said here. It's a disgrace that we have to break the law in order to speak to our government.
Right. It is. This is also the reason why I told the judge at the sentencing, I knew that he had the prerogative of giving me a fine, but that it was my intention not to pay a fine because I did not think that a citizen should have to pay money to have the ear of his government or her government. So that was another reason why I was so gratified that the judge agreed with that and didn't give me a monetary fine, and he easily could have. So, yes, it is disgraceful. And if our government, our Congress, were doing their job and truly representing the will of the people, then we wouldn't have to interrupt to be heard. But, yes, I think it's quite disgraceful that I had to commit a crime in order to get the words out.
Do you think that these public servants, which is a complete joke, do you think any of them, at least the ones that you have seen, feel that ordinary citizens such as yourself should be able to speak?
I haven't heard directly from any congressmen, particularly those on that panel. I know that there are some congressmen and senators who do try to represent the people. Bernie Sanders, Barbara Lee, Dennis Kucinich.
He's gone, right? Kucinich is gone. They got rid of him.
Well, he's still fulfilling the rest of his term, right. But you're right. He will not be reelected to his seat. But there are a handful who I think truly do try to represent the people. I haven't received any bravos from any elected official. Mainly, it's just been the people. I can't imagine that a lot of congresspeople did not see that interruption. It was a pretty big deal at the time. C-SPAN had, I think, about 150,000 views of that videotape. Even though it didn't get major media, I would think that Congress would have seen that. This was a very high-profile situation at the time because if they didn't come up with these cuts, then the sequestration was going to be put into effect. And in fact, they didn't come up with anything. They failed. So it would have been very gratifying to have somebody contact me and say, you're right, Congress has failed the American people, but I haven't heard that from anybody.
Yeah.
Except the people.
You would think that at least one of these people would say to themselves, look, I've already got enough. I served 2 years in the House of Representatives. I could leave right now. I've got a pension for life. I've got health care for life. I've taken enough. Leah is right. We're not giving the people the chance to voice their opinions. Isn't it obvious enough? We're here in front of a bunch of rich lobbyists where there's the Iron Triangle. We're forming public policy outside of the attention of the U.S. public. If you wanted to speak in front of the super committee in a way other than the way you did, could you have?
Absolutely not. No.
Can you be invited to speak?
Well, I think the super committee invited the guy that had the answers that they wanted to hear. No member of the public was invited. The thing is, the Congress doesn't even have to invite testimony to know what the people think. There are all kinds of opinion polls that are done, and constituents write to their congressmen, and they I could have stood outside the Hart office building with a sign saying, tax the rich and end the wars, and in fact, we march in the streets and we say that very thing, but it's not heard. So it took some kind of extraordinary measure. It took an act of breaking the law to get any attention.
Right.
And if I thought that letters would do it, and if I thought that protests would do it, but they don't. And we've seen that over and over and over again. No, there's no other vehicle outside of civil disobedience in order to get your voice heard.
Right.
And it's not just a matter of, okay, well, let's say they had invited me to speak. It still doesn't buy me the access that these lobbyists have that talk to them all the time. It's one little voice compared to the big machine. And why lobbyists have access at all is beyond me. I mean, that should be prohibited. I don't understand that.
The First Amendment.
Well, yeah, the First Amendment being interpreted as speech and money being
exactly.
the same thing.
At this point in time, it might be mm-hmm. different a year from now or 5 years or 10 years or 100 years. When I read what you said, that really hit home when you said that it's such a disgrace that mm-hmm. in order to have your voice heard, you have to break the law. People should be able to simply walk into Congress and say what they want.
Mm-hmm.
These Congress people should welcome them. These Congress mm-hmm. people should shut up, put your microphone down, and listen to what an average American has to say about what you're doing to the country.
Mm-hmm.
They really should be completely ashamed of themselves. And I've said this so many times, I'm sick of saying, I don't know how these people can sleep at night, knowing what they know, that they're not listening to your average American. And like you said, I did want to bring this up. The polls, over and over again, no matter how you slice it, the vast majority of Americans are disgusted with war. They want to get out, but these elites in Congress will not listen to what the people want.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why you're saying, really, we have no other choice but civil disobedience. And you didn't come to this opinion overnight, obviously.
No.
Yeah. Were you nervous?
Yes, a little. I was. On the video, it looks like I'm quite calm and composed, and you can understand what I'm saying. And I think that's why this action was much more successful than the one I did the previous week in front of the Armed Services Committee, where I was yelling and almost immediately had police there pulling me out of the room. And several people have commented, even Dana Milbank, a relatively conservative writer for the Washington Post, said that my protest was thoughtful or something that should be considered, and I wasn't like some raving crazy woman.
Right.
But it is hard not to rave when you know you're right. In retrospect, I wasn't sure immediately afterwards exactly what I'd even said because it was kind of a blur.
Right.
Like I said, I didn't really plan on it. So yes, I was somewhat nervous, but not as much as you might think because I just felt like, God, I can't believe I have to do this. I felt like this is a responsibility to do it. So
I'm glad you did it. And of course, you don't even have to say a word in order to get thrown off the floor or arrested. Look what happened to Ray McGovern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was at a private function. That wasn't even in Congress.
Right.
But he stood with his back to Hillary Clinton and was mauled by police and physically harmed, bruised.
Right.
It's sad. It is sad. But I don't know what people are afraid of. They're afraid of the truth or they're afraid of, I don't know. They feel threatened, though.
But it's been going on for a long time in the United States. And I've talked to people who used to protest the Vietnam War and literally not doing anything, just standing there, maybe mm-hmm. with a sign, and they've been beaten mercilessly. Mm-hmm. Why is it something that was illegal?
Well, the way the judge put it was that he said, although I'm sympathetic with your criticism of the government and that people are maybe not being heard, he said there's like, 300 million people in this country, and I'm sure almost all of them would like to have 52 seconds to speak to Congress. But we can't do it that way because then nothing would get done and no decisions would be made, and you kind of jump to the front of the line by doing that. And I wasn't allowed to rebut the judge at that point, although I really wanted to, but these corporate lobbyists are jumping to the front of the line. They don't have to wait in line at all. And I also wanted to say, but if my representative was actually doing his job, allowed to do his job of representing my interest and the will of the people, then that's the purpose of having representatives. So
yeah.
I wouldn't have to have my 52 seconds because I would be represented by someone else. Anyway, I think the judge had to impose some kind of justification for the sentence, and so he felt like obliged to say something. Technically, that is the law. You can't disrupt. And before the hearings start, the chair of the hearing will usually warn people that they can't disrupt, they can't make noise or hold up signs or different things. It's up to the chair of the committee whether or not you're arrested, though. It has to do with how many times they bang the gavel and what exactly they say. If they ask the police to restore order and they bang it twice, I think, then that's the signal to, yes, arrest this person. But right. They can also just ask that the police remove you from the room, or in some cases, if they just ask you to sit down and be quiet and you do that, then nothing will happen if you do that immediately. But I certainly would have done that.
You kept going, which was great. The Capitol Police came in and took you out. What did they do then after they brought you in?
This is the interesting thing to me, because the police in this case were very, very nice to me. The two police officers that took me out of the room, one of them stayed with me, and they have to maintain physical custody of you at all times. So they handcuffed me, but he just had his hand around my upper arm to hold on to me, but he was just like barely touching me. I have been held by police that left fingerprints, fingertip bruises right on my arms. But this guy was very, very nice. The sergeant, different people came and talked to me and really got the feeling that they were quite sympathetic with what I had done. And then the proof of that was, as I mentioned before, normally if you have a case open, they hold you overnight. But I was not held overnight. And the police officer at the processing station went out of her way. She said, you know, I think that there's a new provision that says that if you have two or more open cases, then you have to be held, but I think maybe that she went out of her way to see if I could be released, and in fact I was, and in fact I was released a couple of hours, which is very, very quick if you've ever been through the process before. Then the ultimate was when I left the building, I was thanked by one of the police officers for what I did.
Wow.
And yeah, and I thought, they have to do their job, and I understand that, and although some police officers are not the friends of activists, I think you also have to remember that most of them are just trying to make a living, and just like I was when I was in the military, and they do what they're supposed to do, and they're just trying to get by and make ends meet, go home to their families, and they're doing their job.
Right.
And I don't think that most police officers are the enemy. I think they're part of the 99% too. Of course, there are some who are abusive or take advantage of their power and their authority, and that's wrong. I want to be very careful not to lump all law enforcement as the opposition.
So this happened October 26th of last year,
mm-hmm.
and you just went in front of the judge a couple of days ago, right?
Right. That's a fairly normal period of time. I went back in November for an initial hearing, and then I went back again in January for the arraignment, and then it would have been the trial. I was entitled to a jury trial for this offense, and I waived my right to the trial to plead guilty. I would like to talk about that a little bit, because
sure.
several people have asked me, you should have pled not guilty, and you should have taken it to trial. And I think if I had done that, it would have changed the focus about why I did what I did. The purpose of a jury of finding 12 peers to come in, and many of them would have to take off work or find babysitters. It's a duty, but it's something that is not convenient for people. So when you ask somebody to be on a jury and you think about what their job is, what they're supposed to do is listen to the evidence and decide if that evidence is compelling enough to convict the accused of the crime for which they've been charged. And in this case, I readily admit what I did. I mean, I was proud of what I did, and I wanted to show the video of what I did. I would not have been allowed to talk about why I did what I did, because that's not evidence. The evidence is, did I continue talking after I was told to stop? Did I cross this threshold? And obviously I did that. I admit I did that. So there's really no purpose of having a jury there to listen to evidence. It's a waste of their time.
Because you're honest.
Right. And so I hope to use the whole incident as a platform to talk about what's wrong with our government. And in fact, that's exactly what's happened. I'm talking to you. I've done so many interviews and writing about it. And then I think if I had just had a jury trial and the jury would have found me guilty, I'm right back where I started. It doesn't make sense to me to plead not guilty to that. I don't know. I just think it's the wrong forum and the wrong way to go in this case.
Right. I agree with that. Was there anyone who could see the rationale behind what you were thinking? Or most people go, what are you, crazy?
No, I think a lot of people question me, and then I explain it to them like that, and then they say, okay, I see how it could work this way, and how pleading guilty can be an effective way to resist. And I think that was validated by the sentence I got. I think the judge was appreciative that I didn't ask for a jury trial and put the government to that expense and unnecessary process. And it's not just the expense. Of course, I'm entitled to my trial, and I'm entitled to a lawyer and to force the government to prove that I did what I did. But if I'm going to admit that I did what I did, then why waste everybody's time?
Exactly. And it only makes sense that you would want to plead guilty because you were proud of what you did. You're speaking for 330 million Americans who neither have the time or the inclination or the courage or the ability to say, you know what, I think that what you're doing here is wrong, and we need a voice, and Americans do need a voice. And for that 52 seconds, you were the voice for many Americans who wished that they could do what you did.
You're right. A lot of people have told me that they wish they could have done that, or even if they had had the opportunity, they're not sure they could have mustered up the courage to walk up. I guess it is a pretty gutsy thing to do. Gall, take some gall. I'm happy that I can do that. I told Tom Hartman this. This is what I can do, and not everybody can do that. Other people, they can write letters, and some people can make financial contributions to the movement or support people who do these kinds of things. So we all do what we can, but we need to push ourselves maybe to branch out and push our own personal comfort zones and go beyond what's comfortable for us as far as speaking out. And so I hope that maybe people who see this will say, man, I couldn't do that, but I can make a trip down to my congressman's office and demand that he listen to me, and that I'm tired of being ignored, and I am going to speak up when I have a chance. I'm going to seek out opportunities to speak up. So I'm hopeful that not only did I get a chance to represent people, but that my actions will encourage and empower them to add their voices and become a more active part of resistance to our government.
That's great. And you were facing jail time, weren't you?
Yeah, the maximum sentence is 6 months. That's why I qualified for a jury trial, because that's pretty serious. And in fact, he did give me 60 days and then suspended that, but I have 9 months of probation. And I'm not sure exactly what would happen if I am arrested again within that 9 months. I'm told that if I am arrested again and the judge here in D.C. finds out about it, then I could be summoned to reappear in court, and then the judge would hear evidence about why he should or should not revoke the suspension and imposed 60 days. I was assessed $50 to be paid to the Victims of Violent Crime Fund, and this is a requirement by law that anyone who is found guilty has to be assessed a minimum of $50, so I was given the minimum. But that's not considered a fine. The judge could have given me a much more significant fine, and he did not. So I do not consider that to be a penalty, really. It goes to help people who are victims. There is debate about whether, because I did not commit a violent crime, should I be forced to pay into this fund, but I will just consider that as a donation to a worthy cause, and it's not punitive.
Right, and then 20 days community service?
Right, and Veterans for Peace is a bona fide 501c3 nonprofit organization, and we had our board meeting this weekend, and I spent many more hours than 20 this weekend working on Veterans for Peace issues. I will be visiting the probation officer on Wednesday and handing him a letter of verification that I completed my community service. So I should be able to be on unsupervised probation for the remainder of my 9-month sentence.
Your probation officer is in Washington, D.C.?
Yes. So the judge gave me supervised probation until I paid the $50 to the Victims of Violent Crime Fund and I completed my 20 hours of community service. So I paid the $50 immediately after the hearing, and then I went to see the probation officer, and he will be satisfied when I see him on Wednesday and give him the documentation. So we should be very quickly able to move to unsupervised status.
That's good, because you sound, I never met you, but you sound like a pretty dangerous person. And, but you live in Oregon, right?
I do.
So you're out here in D.C. just to take care of this matter?
Right.
Just for speaking your mind in the people's house. Like I said, it's obscene. It's all twisted that the high-powered lobbyists can pretty much, they own the place and they could do what they want, but your average American gets arrested and fined and put on probation for speaking for not even 60 seconds. Incredible. And how does Veterans for Peace survive financially?
Well, thank you for asking that. We are supported in very large part by our members, the dues that they pay and the donations that they make. And we have recently been able to hire a part-time development director who does grant writing and that kind of thing. But these days, it is very difficult to get funding. It's just sort of dried up. So we rely heavily on our membership for donations. But what's more important to us than financial support is the engagement and involvement of people in the organization. I certainly wouldn't turn down a donation, but what we really want is people to join our organization. So if they will go to veteransforpeace.org and then follow the links, what we require for a veteran needs to provide us proof of service with their discharge paper or some other document that shows that they were indeed in the military. It makes no difference to us what kind of discharge the person received. And we require all our members, whether they are veteran or non-veteran, to sign an affirmation to our statement a purpose, so they support our goals, and then the dues. And we will either assign you to the chapter closest to you, or we will find a place for you to fit in, find out what issues you're interested in, and if we have a working group on that particular issue, get you hooked up with a working group. We'll send you a t-shirt, just like the one that Scott Olson wore when he was hit in the head with a tear gas canister, or the same that Ray McGovern was wearing when he was taken out after turning his back on Hillary Clinton. And we'll get you hooked up and involved in all the work that we do. So people can be as active or as inactive as they like. You certainly don't have to be arrested. You don't have to risk arrest, and you don't have to be out on the streets. There's all kinds of things that our members do that are helpful to our mission. So you can really participate to whatever level that you're comfortable with.
Right.
Chicago NATO protests are coming up. I already have a plane ticket to go to Chicago from my home in Oregon. And people have said, be careful you're not arrested again. And what I tell them is that I'm certainly not going to seek arrest. And I don't think no activist wants to be arrested. They want to express their views and they want to exercise their First Amendment rights. And they're willing to risk their liberty in order to stand up for themselves and to express those rights. But it's not the goal to be arrested. The goal is to exercise our First Amendment rights, and then the police decide what they have to do or what they feel like they have to do, and you decide whether or not you want to risk that. So what I've decided is that I am going to Chicago. I am not going to be intimidated or afraid to speak up and be a part of the resistance to NATO and be a part of those protests. And as the president of Veterans for Peace, I think it's very important that I be there to help represent my organization. So I will be there. I will not sit at home and be intimidated or afraid of arrest, but I will not seek it out either, of course. So we'll see what happens. I'm hoping for an effective show of opposition to NATO. I'm hoping for nonviolence. I'm hoping that the police will not overreact to our presence. I'm hoping that we will be allowed our First Amendment rights to petition our government and to speak. So we'll see what happens, but I will be there.
Leah Bulger, the president of Veterans for Peace and a great American, I want to thank you so much for the time you took out explaining all this to the listeners. You did something really great, and I'm hoping that nothing happens to you in Chicago because I don't want to see you locked up in a jail in Washington, D.C.
Well, thank you for listening to me for this time. I appreciate being able to tell my story. And if I am locked up, then I will count on you and others like you to get the word out. And we'll make some hay out of this that an activist was jailed for speaking out. So if that happens, then we'll face the consequences when it does.
Well, I'll be there. And again, thanks, Leah, for doing what you do and what you did. I appreciate it, and I'm sure most of the listeners do also. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.